It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And if you don't think it's been a cold spring, then I don't know where you've been, because it's still mighty cool out there. It's supposed to get a little warmer today, but the wind is going to be tearing away at your clothing. I was just looking at some of the stuff that's happening. I see this past week, within the last few days, the lilacs have finally begun to bloom. And just checking back, it looks like average date for the lilacs to begin blooming is the 21st of May. And this year, I saw my first blooms on the 27th. Now, lilacs are one of those things where you have like a cluster of flowers, and I think they're called florets, but anyway, you get this cluster of flowers, and I need to see a whole column of those flowers in bloom before I say the plant is officially first bloom. So the 27th was the first day that I had seen that on lilacs. Now, the lilacs at my house are nowhere near that. They're going to be a while yet before they actually throw blooms, but we're still looking at about a week behind in terms of some of the flowering events that are taking place. This past week, you probably noticed that a lot of the decorative flowering crabapples are blooming. Big, just sheets of pink. I'm looking at some over by the State Bank, on the north side of the State Bank in Grand Rapids, and they are absolutely just clouds of solid pink. My crab apple at home, my flowering crab, is bright pink. My Dolga crab, the edible crab, is covered in white, and it looks pretty good. But you know, both those trees, I was out looking at them and watching them and watching the bumblebees that were there working on them and other bees that came to gather nectar from those flowers. And due to the cold weather, at the most on the one on the decorative crab, I saw four bumblebees one day. But this cool, wet weather has kept the bumblebees, I don't know, kept them away from the apple tree anyway. I'll be interested to see how they do fruit-wise as we get further on into the summer, see what kind of fruit are set. I was looking at the Juneberries in my yard, and they appear to have set some pretty good fruit. It looks like there might be a decent Juneberry crop. I was looking at blueberries yesterday, and there are still a lot of flowers on the blueberries. There are also a number of fruits that are set on the Juneberries, and they don't look that good. I don't know if it's been so cold and wet that we haven't had the bees around that we need to get that job done, but it looks to me like there's going to be, at least in my yard, not a real good crop of blueberries this year. So I'm kind of watching them and hoping for the best. This past week, a week ago today, brought out first reports of goslings, Canada goose goslings, and mallards, hooded mergansers, and American goldeneye all have young out of their nests now. We have first-fledged robins. Of course, the ravens have been fledged for a couple of weeks and been just cutting up and doing all kinds of silly things around the place, and that's sort of fun. White-tailed deer, the young bucks are starting to grow new antlers, and the fawns are now being born. So if you're out looking around for fawns, this is a good time to check them out, and hopefully you'll get a chance to see one before too long. Hoary puccoon, a plant of the western reaches of our listening area, out in the Bemidji area. John Jader and Harvey Jader over there are reporting hoary puccoon, and Dallas Hudson got hoary puccoon down in the Akeley area. I usually see it up on 46 as I'm going toward Winnie and Cutfoot Sioux Lakes to do some fishing. The hoary puccoon looks a lot like cowslips or marsh marigolds, those bright yellow plants that grow in the swamps. But the difference between the cowslips and the hoary puccoon is that the hoary puccoon always grows up on dry, sandy soil. So if you suspect that there's water nearby, it's probably cowslips or marsh marigolds. If you are seeing these plants up on dry, sandy slopes, why, it's probably hoary puccoon. The other difference would be the leaf. The cowslip has a big, round leaf, and the hoary puccoon has a long, narrow leaf. Saw some painted turtles this past week. I don't think that the painted turtles were headed anywhere. I mean, it's not like they're out laying their eggs yet. That'll happen in early June, usually the end of the first week in June. So probably the next time we talk, we'll be looking at painted turtles at least getting started with their egg laying. And I've seen a couple in the past week, but in both cases, they didn't seem to have that imperative where they were out looking for a place to lay eggs. Water arum is blooming in the swamps. This is a broad white leaf structure. Think of calla lilies. And water arum belong to that family. They are a wild calla, sometimes called wild calla. And they're blooming right now in the swamps. And if you are getting into the swamps and doing a little looking around, you would probably want to check, besides the wild calla, you might want to check the buckbean, which is a really interesting plant, and the bog rosemary and the bog laurel. Both of those are pink. The bog rosemary has a little tulip-shaped or blueberry-shaped blossom, and the bog laurel has a big open blossom. And if you look at the bog laurel, that five-pointed pink flower that's about, maybe the size of a dime, maybe a little smaller. If you look carefully, you'll see that the stamens, the male parts of that flower, are tucked into little pockets in the petal itself. And when a insect lands on that plant, it snaps. Those little anthers come whipping through the air and splatter the sides of the insect with pollen. And that helps the bunch berries get pollen, or the bog laurel get pollinated. The reason I said bunch berries there is because I was thinking the same thing is true of bunch berries. They are blooming now in the forest. The bunch berry is that 4, 5, 6 inch tall plant with a four petaled white flower. And if you look carefully at that flower, you'll see that those stamens are also under quite a bit of kinetic energy. And there were some scientists in Wisconsin who did some research on these plants. I think it was at Lawrence University. And they discovered that these same thing happens in bunchberry, is that these anthers are cocked and loaded and ready to go. And the instant an insect comes in to sample the nectar of the plant, those anthers let go and they come snapping out. And I've forgotten now, it's a phenomenally fast response. It's thousands of a second, 4 or 5 G's of force as these things come snapping forward. Fortunately, there's not much mass there, or these insects would probably be killed instantly by these male flower parts slapping them with pollen. But both the bog laurel and the bunchberry, which are both blooming right now, have this same characteristic. They're cocked and loaded and ready for somebody to land on them. And when they do, bang, they slap them with pollen. Winterberry, also known as northern holly, has just begun to leaf out this past week. Black ash began leafing out this past week. I saw my first Canada columbine. Those are those bright red flowers that have 5 points on them. Oftentimes you look at those columbine and you probably are calling them honeysuckle. Whenever I talk to a group, and usually especially when I'm talking to school kids, when they see the picture of the columbine, they say honeysuckle. And they say that because these five little tubes that stand up on top of the flower, like points on a king's crown, these tubes and these little balls at the end have nectar in them, and they're quite sweet. And the plant is red, with a yellow center, and it's designed to be frequented by hummingbirds. The columbine that exist in Europe do not have those long spurs because there are no hummingbirds in Europe. The hummingbird is an American, North American bird, or an American bird, a Western Hemisphere bird. And they come to these columbine. They hover below the flower, and they run their proboscis, their beak, well up into the flower, and then they extend their tongue beyond that, and they drink that nectar that's way up at the top of those little five little pointed spurs. And while they're doing that, if you look at the structure of the flower, if you look carefully at a columbine, you'll see that all of the male parts, all of the stamens are hanging down there right where they can touch the hummingbird right in the throat. So she gets a load of pollen on her throat when she's there drinking the nectar. And when she flies to the next plant, if it happens to be receptive, the stigma, the female part, is sticking down below all of those little pollen carriers. And she will rub that pollen on the stigma, and the plant will be fertilized. And as it goes to seed, watch the flower, because they are decumbent, that is, they hang down while they are in flower. And when they go to seed, they straighten back up and they stand up, so the seed pod gets reversed from sort of a 180-degree change in direction for the seed pod once the plant is in the seed stage. In the meantime, if you find these things, these wild columbine, pick one and nip off those five little knobs at the end of those spurs, and you will have a nice little mouthful of sweet, sugary drink there. It's quite good. Last week, just about the time we talked, and the next day, the willows were putting out some of their cottony seeds, and I don't know if it was aspen or if it was actually shrub willow like the pussy willows. I suspect it was pussy willows because it didn't last very long. It was over in a couple of days, and usually when the amount of cotton in the air wasn't significant, in the sense that when the trembling aspen start to throw their cotton, usually it forms rings around every puddle, shows up on the shores of lakes. It really, really, really is a pretty unmistakable event when the aspens start putting out their cotton. So I think this might have been the willow shrubs that were putting out cotton last week. I've been watching the pink moccasin flowers at my house, and I have both the lowland and the upland patch. I have one patch that's right down on the edge of the swamp, and I have another patch that's up high in the tree farm under the pines in that really acid soil and dry sandy soil. And it's pretty amazing that this flower would take both of those extreme locations. But the ones that grow by the swamp are much taller. They're probably 18 centimeters tall. And the ones that are growing up in the woods are more like 13 centimeters. And they both have blossoms on them. But there will be some larger ones up in the pine plantation. There'll be larger plants coming along. There are lots of leaves coming up right now. So they're going to be a good crop of pink lady slippers this year. Same thing is true of the yellow lady slippers. They are budded but not yet blooming, so keep an eye out on those. While you're wandering around the woods, take a look at the lycopodium. There's a little lycopodium, we used to call it princess pine, and I think the round-branched ground pine is the full name that's sometimes used. Lycopodium dendroideum is the actual scientific name, but these tiny little plants that are like, they look like miniature trees. They're about 5-6 inches tall. If you look at them right now, there's new growth on the ends of each of these limbs, and so you have this little bit of lime green at the end of a very dark green branch, but we're talking about, you know, an eighth of an inch of lime green at the end of a 3-inch branch, so it's really quite stunning to look at the ground pine right now. Canada Mayflower, sometimes called False Lily of the Valley, is blooming. Starflower is blooming. Starflower is unmistakable. 7 petals for the most part, bright white petals. And the plant itself, when I ask kids about it and they're looking at it on the ground, They say that the leaves even look star-like. So the star flower is pretty hard to miss. Dwarf raspberry. This is one that Harry Hutchins taught me. I didn't realize there was such a thing. But here are these little plants that are about, oh, 6, maybe 10 inches tall. They've got 3 leaves that look very much like raspberry leaves. And right now, each of those plants has 1, sometimes 2, 5-petaled white flowers, and they are probably at their peak of bloom right now. And there will be raspberries on them, and they're quite good, though they're not very plentiful. Bog birch is fully leafed out right now and just delightful. Those leaves are so pretty to look at. And bog birch, of course, where is it? In the bog. And you will stumble across it while you're out there. It's really easy to identify. It's got this dark gray bark with lenticels, little white knots on it, little white lenticels on it. And then it has these leaves that are, maybe the size of a nickel and fluted along the edge. They're very, very pretty. I was looking at my patch of blueberries the other day, and I noticed that I had both the velvet leaf blueberry and the lowbush blueberry growing side by side. Not a lot of velvet leaf in with the lowbush, but definitely one clump was definitely velvet leaf. And they are a bit retarded from the lowbush. The lowbush appear to be fully in bloom, while the velvet-leaved blueberries just appear to be starting to bloom. So we'll watch them and see how that develops. If you're out walking around in the woods, keep your eye out for purple clematis, these beautiful 3-4-inch-long blossoms that are pale bluish purple, and they're hanging down from these vines. The clematis is a vine, grows up over everything, and can be seen right now in great quantities because of the flowers that are all over it. Really, really pretty. And gay wings, sometimes called fringe polygala, the magenta-colored little flower right down at the ground, 3-4 inches up off the ground, is blooming. Red elderberry appears to be probably at its peak. Jack in the Pulpit, blue cohosh, red baneberry, all of those are blooming right now. The Jack in the Pulpits are starting to really show off. Blue cohosh, which is a plant of very, very rich soils, usually found in the presence of sugar maples, basswoods, yellow birch, that kind of a forest, look to be at their peak. I mentioned that common lilacs were blooming in the swamps. The tussock sedge, Carex stricta, is covered with flowers right now. Just beautiful. And the male flower stands at the top, bright yellow bottle brush sort of a thing. Got all these little threads sticking out to the sides that are yellow, and that's the male flower. And below that, 3, sometimes 2, sometimes 4 white-tipped female flowers are all over the tussock sedge, hummock sedge, that's blooming right now. And if you've been walking the back roads, you probably have noticed the spruce bud scales are all over the ground. Just everywhere you look, there are spruce bud scales everywhere. And finally this week, one last note that I wanted to bring to your attention, and that is that on Saturday, I saw my first tiger swallowtail butterfly. That's the big black and yellow one that's pretty obvious. I guess yellow and black, predominantly yellow with lots of black veining. It's got some orange and blue dots on the wings, but what you're going to notice is this big butterfly, monarch-sized butterfly, bright yellow with black veins all through its wings. And looking at past records, the average date for the first tiger swallowtail is the 24th of May, and this year I saw my first one on the 28th. And I would expect to see some today or tomorrow if the winds don't get too bad, especially as the temperature warms up. Generally, these guys are out and about when it starts to get warm in the spring. And there's a kind of a relationship between them and the migrating monarch butterflies. So I would keep my eye out for monarch butterflies as well. Think Ed Dallas and... Dallas Hudson. Too many Dallases. Dallas Hudson and his friend John Weber have a sort of a relationship between the first sighting of the tiger swallowtail and the monarch butterfly, and it turns out that the average span between those two is about 3 days. My records are a little bit spottier than theirs, but we'll see. I'll be watching for the tiger swallowtail butterflies today, tomorrow, and possibly the rest of this week, as well as some monarchs too. So, lots of things to look at out there. The woods is absolutely full of birds, which I did not even bother to talk about today, but there are birds and plants and flowers and insects and, wow, hundreds of things to look at. So get out, keep your eyes open, and don't forget to tell us what you're seeing. It's time for Talk Back. Talk Back is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you got an observation of nature you'd like to share, a comment you'd like to make, or a question you'd like to pose. It doesn't matter. We're waiting to hear from you, and you can get in touch with us by calling our Talk Back number. That is 999-9876. You can also reach us by email at comments@kaxe.org. You can reach me personally by sending your emails to Jay Latimer, that's J-L-A-T-I-M-E-R, @kaxe.org. And, of course, you can always write us a letter. We'd love to get your letters, and they can be sent to 260 Northeast 2nd Street, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, 55744. Well, there are a lot of things going on out there, and lots of things to look at. Boy, the days are long, and the view is magnificent. The colors are mostly green, but there are certainly a lot of them. So get out, look around, and send us your notes. We did hear from Sam and Beth, who are up in the Mackinac Palo area, and they said this morning, Sunday, about 8:55, Beth and I were driving west on County Road 16, about 9 miles west of our home in Palo, headed toward Highway 53. A young moose came crashing out of the brush, ran a few yards along the road, and then back into the brush. An awesome sight. And yesterday, we were driving to Ashland, Wisconsin. We saw two black bear in different locations and what we think was a timber wolf by a deer carcass. Boy, they captured all of the charismatic megafauna right there. Moose, deer, bear. Golly, they got it all. Wolf, man. I wish I'd have been in that car. That sounded like a fun drive. I could have been entertained. We also heard from our good friend Karen, whose pictures adorn the internet from time to time, and she was out in her kayak and caught sight of the bog rosemary. This is a little pink flower, kind of a little bell-shaped pink flower that you'll find in the bogs. Not to be confused with the bog laurel, which is also blooming right now in great profusion. And if you're in the bogs, you might as well look around for some buckbean, maybe a pitcher plant or two. There's lots of things to see in the bogs, and many of them are coming into flower right now. We heard from Dallas Hudson, who is over in Akeley, Minnesota, and Dallas has been out kind of censusing the butterflies. He and John Weber, who lives in Nevis, were out doing a little early spring butterfly count, and they found silvery blues, azures, eastern and western tailed blues, mustard whites, Olympias, marbles, commas, dusky wings, and they saw some dragonflies, including the four spotted skimmers. And Dallas reports seeing the first fawn of the season this year. So if you are out and about and looking around, why, maybe you'll see a fawn as well. I was at my in-laws last night, and they reported seeing a doe with a swollen udder. Thought that she either had a fawn nearby or perhaps was about to give birth in the next few days. So the fawns and the deer are definitely in that stage of their development where the babies are being born. So keep your eyes open. Looking at the Minnesota Phenology Network site on Facebook, I see that Amanda Watkins, who lives in southern Itasca County, reports columbine blooming, bunch berry blooming, bluebead lily is budded up, perhaps will be blooming in the next day or so, starflower, Canada Mayflower, baneberry, lots of flowers out there to check out. Dragonflies, I noticed a bunch of dragonflies myself, and unlike Dallas Hudson, I wasn't able to identify them, just that there were dragonflies buzzing my yard for the first time this year back on Friday and Saturday. So we'll have to keep an eye out for those. And our good friends Sophie and Gracie, who live up on Dixon Lake, sent along some notes saying that American golden eyes, hooded mergansers, and mallards are all seen swimming about, being trailed by young ducklings. Gray tree frogs were calling up there. Trilliums are blooming in fair numbers in the woods. And they got a chance to watch a couple of male snapping turtles fighting in Third River. And I don't know how you tell the males from the females, except maybe the males are the ones that do the fighting. I don't know, but those snappers, boy, I've seen some pictures, film of snappers wrestling, and it can get pretty vicious out there. They really can go after it. So, but don't worry, you know, my wife confessed to having a great fear of snapping turtles, which kept her out of a lot of the area lakes, not all, but many. And I tried to tell her that, you know, your odds of being attacked by a snapping turtle are probably akin to being struck by a meteorite. It's not really something that you need to spend a lot of time worrying about, especially if you stay on dry land the way she does. But I understand you would not want to be grabbed by a snapping turtle. It takes a bit to get them to let go. From our good friend Joel, who sent along some notes from the Mattawa area. He said, last week I was cutting firewood at the edge of our ash swamp and noticed a small downed black ash that looked dry and still sound. As I walked over to buck it up, I nearly stepped on a little fawn that was curled up in a depression. I later returned with my son and a camera and took a photo. Weather warmed nicely over the weekend, and we got some new developments like star flowers and the first domestic asparagus. But Memorial Day has turned out chilly with a fresh wind off Lake Superior and barely getting above 50 for a short time. Based on my observations of benchmarks like domestic apples, lilacs, and black ash leafing, we are running about 3 weeks behind last year and a week behind 2009. Last year, lilacs and domestic apples were at about peak bloom on the 30th, and the black ash were leafed out. In 2009, lilacs and apples had started blooming, and the ash had started leafing out by the 30th. This year, it looks like those events will occur sometime late this week if the east wind quits blowing off the big lake and it warms up. Unlike many of your reporters, I'm finding fewer wood ticks this year than the past few years. Still expecting a big hatch of mosquitoes, but so far it hasn't been too bad. Tree frogs are quite loud, and the peepers are still calling in the evenings. That from Joel in Park Lake, on the shores of Park Lake. And I should tell Joel that should he find that the mosquitoes really don't measure up to his expectations, I'd be happy to mail him some. I seem to have plenty. That's our talkback show for today. If you'd like to talk to us, communicate with your friends, or just get some messages out there about what you're seeing in your neighborhood, please send them along.
You're listening to Phenology Plus on KAXE, Community Radio for Northern Minnesota, 91.7 on the Iron Range, Mizpah, and Mattawa, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, 105.3 in Bemidji, audio streaming on the internet at KAXE.org. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Still ahead on the program, we'll meet an Ojibwe woman who's walking from Hudson Bay across northern Minnesota to Lake Superior to draw attention to the importance of keeping the Great Lakes waters clean. Also, Harry Hutchins remembers Aldo Leopold's daughter, Nina. Nina did a lot to sustain her father's legacy for more than 50 years. Nina Leopold died last week at age 93. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Atchison Tire Company in Grand Rapids. Locally owned for more than 90 years, Atchison Tires offered new tires and repair services for generations of their customers online at atchisontire.com. We also have support from the Bonner Eye Clinic in Grand Rapids. For over 45 years, the Bonner Eye Clinic has served the eye care needs of Grand Rapids, Itasca County, and the Iron Range, providing full-service ophthalmology, cataract and LASIK refractive surgery, plus eye exams for glasses and contacts. The Minnesota Women's Woodland Network is hosting a variety of programs in June. Coming up this Thursday, June 2nd, the network is hosting a tree identification program. That's Thursday evening at 6 o'clock at Ely Lake Park in Eveleth. The outing will cover the key distinguishing features for identifying oaks, maples, spruce, pines, and other trees native to northern Minnesota. Children are welcome. The program is free. And then the following Thursday, June 9th, Minnesota Women's Woodland Network is hosting a program on invasive trees and other plant species. That'll be at 5:30 in the evening in Holyoke Township in Carleton County. You will learn to identify invasive species and how they affect the forest landscape. And then on Monday, June 13th, the Minnesota Women's Woodland Network and the DNR in Bemidji are hosting a bog walk. That'll be from 10:15 in the morning till noon at Lake Bemidji State Park. You will see what's blooming, learn about the unique growing conditions found in the bog, and look for the birds and other wildlife that prefer the bog habitat. Bring your water bottle, binoculars, and camera. All these programs are free and open to everyone. They'd like you to register in advance, so give us a call at KAXE for more information. 218-326-1234. A group of Ojibwe women from Canada and the United States are participating in the Mother Earth Water Walk. Their destination is Lake Superior, where they will bring water they have carried all the way from Hudson Bay and other Great Lakes areas to pour into Lake Superior. In recent weeks, the group from the West has been walking from southern Manitoba across northern Minnesota. We caught up with one of the walkers, Lee Hardy, this morning as she and the other walkers were passing through Swan River on their way to Duluth.
The destination is Bad River, Wisconsin, for June 12th or 11th.
And Lee, when did this walk begin?
It began on, this year it began April 10th in the western direction. We're coming from all the four directions. The northern direction is near Fort Frances, Ontario. The southern direction is near Wisconsin Black River Falls. The eastern direction is near Naren, Ontario. Okay. They're getting ready to cross the river to the United States. Okay, do you want to know when it started?
Sure.
How it started? Okay, at an American Indian Movement Sundance in Pipestone, Minnesota, Elder Eddie Benton Benet, he told the people, he said, in 30 years, if we don't do anything, the water is going to cost as much as an ounce of gold. And he asked the crowd, what are you going to do about it? So Grandmother Josephine heard this, and then she brought it back to women in Thunder Bay, her hometown where she lives. And they came up with the idea about walking around Lake Superior. Somebody said, one of the ladies says, yeah, I can just see Josephine walking around the lake with a pail of water. So that's when it started. It was decided to start in Bad River, Wisconsin, near the lodge where all the water songs are known. Josephine started walking in 2003. She was walking with a staff carrier. Because ladies on their moon time are not allowed to touch the pail or the staff, she was the only woman carrying the water. And after, I think, a day of walking, just the two of them, an elder pulled up, and he said of how he heard when he was a child that he was going to see the Aboriginal woman walk around the Great Lakes. So Josephine asked the staff carrier, Mario, does that mean we have to do all the Great Lakes? And then he said, I guess so. So then it was decided to do all the Great Lakes. And when the Great Lakes were finished, they said, well, the water goes out to the ocean. You're not finished yet. So they decided to do the St. Lawrence and follow the water out to the ocean. And 2010, there was no water walk. But a lady had a dream or a vision or suggestion about the Four Direction Walk, from bringing the water back to Lake Superior, where it started. So the waters are from the directions are going to be put back into Lake Superior in the hopes that this will bring cleansing and to remind people about our specialness, sacredness of the water. The Mother Earth Water Walk is grateful for all the support. Initially, the walk was for the youth to participate. Right now, more walkers are needed. There are coordinators in each direction. You can check it out on MotherEarthWaterWalk.com.
So, Lee, how did you get involved in the Mother Earth Water Walk?
Well, personally, I wanted to do something environmental as a child. And then as a woman, Aboriginal woman, I was told about our responsibility for the water. And I was asking myself, what can I do? And when this came up, I was fortunate enough to live in the same town as Josephine and Melvina, the grandmothers with the idea. And prior to that, my son got kidney failure, and I heard that the highest rate of kidney failure was found around the Great Lakes. So that inspired me to join in as much as possible. On one of the walks, there was a South American Aboriginal living in Canada, and we were doing the walk on Lake Erie, and he was filming us, and then finally he caught up to us, and he honored us, and he told us of the time when, right now, he said there are wars being fought in South America over the water. So he was really impressed with what we're doing, that we're able to actually do this. In South America, they wouldn't be able to do this. If anybody would like to come out, you're welcome.
Where are you from?
Me, I live in Thunder Bay, but I'm from Lake Nipigon. It's right north of Thunder Bay. Mm-hmm. It's actually called another Great Lake, the Sixth Great Lake. That's my hometown, my home area.
What is your community like there?
My community, I haven't lived on my community since I was a child. It's a small community, yeah, and my most special place is right by the lake. My brothers and my father still fish in the lake, but now it's starting to get developed more, that area, more, they're looking for, you know, mining is coming in, so we're going to start getting crowded out there too. People are becoming more aware environmentally of what they're doing, so that's what we have to do. We're all becoming aware of what we do to our earth, eh? And that's ourselves, eh? Because
mm-hmm.
The earth's going to be here. It's just our humanness, our human errors and wrongs, and not thinking of what we're doing. Well, check us out, MotherEarthWaterWalk.com.
Okay, Lee. Travel safely. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Lee Hardy is a member of a group of Ojibwe women on the Mother Earth Water Walk. They're heading from Four Directions to the Bad River Anishinaabe community in northern Wisconsin. You're listening to Phenology Plus on 91.7 KAXE. I'm Scott Hall, and the Headwaters Science Center in Bemidji is starting two separate programs this month. Coming up in June, Chris Tolman from the Headwaters Science Center will lead a birdwatching class for young people June 13th through the 17th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. each day. The class is geared for 3rd through 8th graders and will take place at the Science Center with field trips to Lake Bemidji State Park and other outdoor sites. The class will cover binocular use, field guides, tips for bird identification, bird habitat, how to start a life list, and projects that attract birds to your backyard. And then the Headwaters Science Center in Bemidji is also hosting an Echo Explorer program for people of all ages. Participants will learn, among other things, to collect and identify insects and plants, build a bird feeder, and keep a nature journal. Echo Explorers will meet 10 consecutive Fridays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and that starts Friday, June 17th. For registration information for either program, call KAXE 218-326-1234. Time now for a talk on the wild side with John Latimer and Harry Hutchins. Harry is a forest ecologist and instructor at Itasca Community College. And in this conversation, Harry and John talk about how important bogs and wetlands are for wildlife and water quality. And Harry remembers Nina Leopold. She died last week after many years of continuing the conservation legacy of her father, Aldo Leopold.
I just wanted to mention for listeners out there that may have especially had a chance to go and see the new film out on Aldo Leopold and the Land Ethic, and his oldest daughter, Nina Leopold, died Wednesday at 93. And she, I know, was still doing a little bit of phenology. You know, John, you had done a lot of work in phenology, and she's the one that actually published about 50 years worth of data back around in the late 90s, like 1999 or something. She had a kind of a seminal publication that really brought phenology in the light of how important it is, especially for people that have been keeping long-time data. And she kept up her father's initial run at it back in the starting in the late 30s. They still have a whole cadre of people still working at that and keeping his data up, and of course Nina was very big on that. You know, I had a chance to meet her a couple times and talk with her, and the thing that I think strikes everybody is just how she's not one of these kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of in your face or real strong personalities telling you what to do. She was always such a gentle, kind person, and yet very compassionate about the environment and wanted to communicate to people just how important it was to recognize these things and people to make sure they took this in stride in their life and trying to continue on her father's, what he started with his writings and his ecological thoughts. We lost another great conservationist, but you can go to the Aldo Leopold Foundation, take a look at that website, and there's some very nice obituaries about her and thoughts.
You know, the work that she did and the work that her father did will live on, and that's a good thing. So
the grandkids are working on it now. So
excellent.
It's continuing on as far as I've been able to see. Yeah. So One of the other things, people are talking about these cold, rainy days, and I just wanted to point out again, and I mentioned this on the show earlier, but this stops you to look and stop by those wetlands, because they're doing one heck of a service for us. And I know we had, for example, back in 1991, Minnesota's biggest oil spill in March, right over here in Grand Rapids, a little over 1 million gallons. And if, of course, one of those wetlands soaked up a good part of it. And the fortunate thing, if you have to call that a fortunate thing, was that there was quite a bit of ice still. So they were able to cut the ice out and haul it away to a containment site. But one of the other things to keep in mind is how important those wetlands are. They're like sponges, and they're soaking up this rain real well. And I know you've been out in some of the wetlands already, and you've been talking about the plants blooming. And one of the things that I think is important for people to realize is to stop and look at it and take a look at how the water is doing in those wetlands. And they're really doing you quite a service. And we like to put cement in them, and we like to put roads through them and things like that. And we look at them as places that don't have a lot of value. But boy, not only that might they breed some insects, but they certainly act like important sponges to make sure they reduce the flooding that we're seeing in so many parts of the United States.
Yeah, sure. And just slowing that water flow down gives it a chance to clean itself up.
Yeah.
So they really are performing a valuable service. And I think as time goes on, people are going to discover more and more how important wetlands are.
Yeah. So anyways, there's a lot of neat functions going on there besides the plants there. And you're talking about some of the waterfowl and things that are being bored. Get out there and spend a little time by a wetland and recognize how important they are to you.
Yeah, lots of flowers out there, lots of really obvious flowers and some not so obvious flowers. The carex, different sedges are all flowering, and boy, it's like a whole different world because their flowers are so unique and so different from what we're used to.
And some rushes.
And rushes, yes.
John Latimer and Harry Hutchins with A Talk on the Wild Side. And if you have a question for Harry and John or a topic you'd like them to cover in A Talk on the Wild Side, let us know. Send us an email to comments@kaxe.org, or you can call our talkback line 218-999-9876. Finally this week on Phenology Plus, birder Molly Hoffman takes us into a northern bog, looking and listening for birds of late spring.
I'm trying to record the song of a ruby-crowned kinglet, and the biggest problem is all the interfering sounds. The kinglet is going dee 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 dee. It's pretty repetitive, but it's not very loud and it's not very close. Just as I think I'm close enough, a robin starts singing, so I guess we're just not going to get that ruby-crowned kinglet. Robins, by the way, also nest out on the bog, so it's not unusual to hear them here. You can hear that wonderful warbly song ahead of me. It's a rose-breasted grosbeak, which may seem odd because you might have them around your yard too, but they do like these bogs. Along with that grosbeak, I also hear some red-breasted nuthatches. They're doing that yank, yank, yank song. This is a red-breasted nuthatch. I would not expect to see a white-breasted nuthatch in the bog. But this little guy is perfectly at home. There seems to be kind of a contest going on here. That's the rose-breasted grosbeak, the real musical sound. Trying to sing also with him is a robin, which I think is very musical too, but it's said to be less musical than the grosbeak. A little bit more phrased song. Of course, it's hard to hear anything over the grosbeak, the rose-breasted grosbeak. And you could hear a white-throated sparrow singing its whistle song. That's the sound of a bird, a woodpecker, known as a flicker. And actually, sometimes he makes another sound which actually goes flicka, 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 flicka. But flickers are woodpeckers. They excavate their own nest holes. They're kind of interesting birds because sometimes they're seen on the ground and people don't even know they're a woodpecker. But they have a habit of going to ants. Anthills. Ants are very bad tasting. They have formic acid, which is a terrible tasting substance, apparently. Not a problem for flickers. But we have what they call the yellow shafted sort of form. Not real musical, you know, but that's the sound he makes. There is a red shafted form further west. And we've actually seen an intermediate, which is kind of an orange shafted. Shafted means that the feathers underneath the wings are yellow, quite bright and quite beautiful. Not a lot of variety. You hear that phrased kind of warbly song? That's the song of a purple finch. We find those in so many different places, I can't really characterize exactly where, but there's usually kind of a boreal forest component. And we're actually out on the bog mat here. And they're very beautiful musical singers. They're called purple finches. They're raspberry colored, not purple. And they'll come to your feeders in the winter, and he just flew further away. So I don't think I'll get any more close songs. But purple finch, they're really quite lovely birds.